He really has a broad range of experience because he started out and was on the staff of the United Mine Workers, so I think he knows coal from bottom to the top. And then we have Mr. John Landis, who is the Senior Vice President of General Atomics, which, as you know, most of you know, is partly owned by Gulf Corporation and the Royal Dutch Shell Group. And they have the high-temperature gas reactor. They're doing some of the world's leading work in nuclear fusion. Even the Russians are copying some of the things they are doing. And then to speak to us on oil is Milton F. Searle, who is now with the Electric Power Research Institute. Before going there, he was the chief economist for the energy policy staff of the Office of Science and Technology before it was abolished. And he's also the chief economist for the Atomic Energy Commission. Now, Mr. Gunning has some slides that he'll use to illustrate his talk. And the other panelists and I were going down here. So, Mr. Gunning, would you like to start off?
Okay, is everyone all set? You know, with an energy shortage and everything, I wonder if you could knock those lights out. They hit me right in the eye, and I don't think they're necessary. Listen, I appreciate the opportunity to join you today for this very topical discussion on fuels for electric power supply. Now, in discussions with your chairman, Howard Barnes, it was agreed my own role would be to set the framework for subsequent remarks by our other panel members on the individual sources of energy. And to do this, I'll attempt to deal largely with demand parameters in general and not only with the electric utility market, since those other needs will influence the fuel supply dynamics in the electric market as well. And I must admit that mine is not an enviable task. At this particular point in time, because of great uncertainty in future political and pricing trends that impact all forms of energy, as well as the consumer's reaction to them on a worldwide basis, it's pretty hard to forecast energy demand and supply. And after our luncheon speaker's remarks, it might even be dangerous. As you recall, he said that the solution to the energy problem is to kill the economists who talk about it. Now, we're still faced with this uncertainty, and a lot of the energy forecaster, therefore, is particularly hazardous. Not that hazardous, I hope. Nevertheless, I don't enjoy the luxury of not being able to participate in this dialogue. Even if I would like to wait for the dust to settle over the next year or two, informed speculation at this point in time is probably going to be of greater benefit to planners than some consensus pronouncements made at a much later date. So with the necessary caveats out of the way, let's review for a moment the current situation. A recent partial interruption in our foreign oil supply during the war in the Middle East focused attention on problems that arise for businesses and for individuals when their energy supply is threatened by shortages. The sudden nature of this event, plus the quantum jumps in oil and then subsequently electricity prices in various parts of the country, effectively shocked all consumers in the United States. This shock and the energy consumers' reaction to it has altered the outlook for energy. Before the shock, our analysis, for example, of energy and economic relationships indicated a growing oil product shortage in the United States, at least into 1977, primarily due to a worldwide shortage in refinery capacity. In short, it would have been a continued seller's market for oil products. Since that time, however, there have been significant adjustments in energy consumption patterns both here and overseas. Private consumers, as well as commercial and industrial users, are now striving to improve efficiency and to conserve in their energy use patterns. I'm not referring to the very dramatic declines that were registered at the height of the energy crisis earlier this year, but rather more pervasive and gradual changes that will tend to cool down the future rate of growth for energy, both here and overseas. These reactions, by reducing anticipated demand, have already largely mitigated the acute oil product shortage that had been in prospect for the U.S. prior to the embargo. Thus, we now anticipate only a tight supply and demand balance for some of the lighter oil products over the intermediate term. Similar factors are affecting electricity, coal, and to a lesser extent, natural gas, at least temporarily. And this has led some to downgrade the energy supply crisis to the status of a manageable problem. While there is now some truth in what they say, such an approach may turn out to be a dangerous oversimplification if it lulls us into a false sense of security and slows development of additional supply sources. We now have a chance to catch up, and we must not waste it. Now, in order to illustrate how all this relates to the overall energy picture in the United States, I'd like to show you a number of charts that cover what seems to be evolving for the longer term on the demand side. To put it in perspective, let's first take a look at how energy is utilized in this country today. If I could have the lights, please. There we go. Okay. Now look, there are a great many different uses of energy in the United States, and it's not possible to talk about them all here. But they can be put into the four major categories you see at the top of this rather involved chart. Industry and commerce currently account for 36% of consumption of all primary energy. The electric utilities, which are of particular interest to you, take roughly a quarter. The residential market, shown there in red, takes only about 13% in terms of primary energy, and most of that is for space heating purposes, while the transportation market accounts for the remainder. Now, we all recognize, of course, that electric utilities are not end users of primary energy. They're processors. Currently, nearly 70% of the electricity they produce is sold to industry, commerce, and business. Industry and commerce and government, I should say. So when we add that to direct consumption of energy by industry commerce, we find that business on this basis accounts for more than half of the consumption in the country at stationary sources. The rest of the electricity goes to private dwellings, and when we add that in, the residential use of energy then accounts for 21% of the total. Now, of the remainder, the transportation market, a little more than half is used in the form of gasoline by all privately owned vehicles. A little less than half is required by all commercial vehicles, including, of course, the airlines, railroads, buses, etc. Now, let's take a look at what has and has not changed since we at Chase Manhattan last worked up our detailed long-term estimates on energy trends several years ago. I can get this forward. There we go. Okay. Now, this is one area where change has occurred. Consideration of trends. Nope. That's better. Good. Consideration of trends and the outlook for energy must always begin with the basics. The consumption of primary energy in any form depends on people. Their needs, either directly or indirectly, are the source of economic activity in all markets. And this activity requires fuels of one sort or another. And as you can see in this chart, an increase in the U.S. resident population was exceptionally large during the 15 years prior to 1970, and our numbers had risen to about 204 million by that date. Now, the increasing popularity of family planning during the past few years, however, has led to an exceptionally sharp decline in the birth rate. While the total number of Americans will continue to grow during the next dozen years, the expansion of them will be less than originally thought. According to our original estimates, which used the Conservative Bureau Census Series D population estimates, we should have added about 37 million people between 1970 and 1985. Now, it looks like we're actually going to add only about 30 million people, because their Series E, even lower Series E projections, seem to be the more likely at this time. Even at that lower level, however, this still necessitates a substantial increase in the nation's energy requirements. But there is another population factor, not at all changed, that is likely to boost energy consumption even more than normal. And this is the really explosive growth anticipated for the 20 to 35 year age group. Can I have the next slide, please? Now, you'll note here that as a result of the low birth rate of the depression-ridden 30s, there was very little increase in the young adult population in the United States through 55. The picture brightened somewhat during the following 15-year period, particularly in the later years when the beginning of the post-war baby boom began to be felt. As you can see, however, a really startling increase of nearly 19 million will occur in the 20 to 35-year age group during the forecast period. Now, growth is more than double the previous 15 years and only almost 18 times as large as the growth during the 1940 through 55 period. Individuals in this age group are above average consumers of many types of goods and services, including energy. They're spenders rather than savers, and it's a time of life when most people marry, become parents, purchase homes, furniture, autos, and the multitude of appliances or services that have become necessities in modern American life. Exceptional growth in this age group, therefore, stimulates economic activity to a major degree. In terms of energy requirements, this leads to sharp new advances in per capita consumption, even when we assume some impact for higher prices and a conservation ethic. I have the next slide, please. Now, another of the demographic factors that influence demand remains unchanged by our recent energy shock. And this is the future number of licensed drivers on the road. Again, because of the change in the age mix of the population, the driving age population will increase sharply through 85. And the number of licensed drivers will rise more rapidly than during the previous 15 years. The increment will be almost 40 million above the 1970 level and 21% greater than the growth during the previous 15-year period. By the end of this time, almost two-thirds of the total population will be licensed and presumably anxious to drive an automobile. We have the next slide. Now, this leads inevitably to the conclusion that barring a condition of permanent recession, new automobile sales will continue to rise over the forecast period. The net addition to our stock to meet this surge of new drivers is estimated to be more than 40 million vehicles. Growth will be about 16% greater than that occurred during the previous 15 years. Now, Detroit may indeed build these cars smaller and lighter and perhaps design them to run more efficiently. But no matter how you cut it, an increase of that magnitude still translates into a good rate of expansion for gasoline demand in particular for another decade at least. A great deal of energy will also be required for the initial production of these vehicles and their individual components. I have the next slide, please. Now, this is another important and unchanged element of population growth that will be stimulating energy demand, and it must be accommodated during the forecast period. The number of young people entering the civilian labor force is accelerating rapidly again due to the higher birth rates experienced prior to the late 60s. Our total labor force will be increasing by 17 million people between now and 1985, the 73 and 85. Now, these are bright, motivated individuals with high expectations for the future. If the United States is to gain full advantage of their high potential, the nation and the national economy must grow and prosper in order to generate adequate private employment opportunities for them. The ethic of a zero or low growth economy advocated in certain circles within this country would certainly reduce energy needs. It would also inevitably lead to crippling unemployment, or at best, innovating make-work jobs in the public sector. Now, this would be, in our opinion, an absolute disaster for these new young workers and for the country as a whole. Can I have the next slide, please? Now, the key to maintaining that satisfactory level of employment over the longer term, as well as upgrading living standards for the disadvantaged in this country, are policies that force a continued growth in the economy. This will require an increasing application of energy in one form or another. For many years, there's existed a remarkable correlation between the energy input and the real value of goods and services produced in this country. Roughly 16 barrels of oil equivalent energy, and we use oil equivalent energy because most people can visualize a barrel where they can't visualize a kilowatt hour or BTU. At least people can visualize a beer barrel if they can't even visualize an oil barrel. Now, we've needed roughly 16 barrels of oil equivalent energy for every $1,000 of real GNP, with only minor fluctuations since about 1950. We chart here the actual relationship for 1955 and for 1970, plus our original projections for 1985. And you'll note that future GNP for that year was calculated at $1.3 trillion in real terms. And this, we believe, would have been sufficient to maintain relatively full employment in the country over this period. We worked up the energy forecast, on the other hand, by analysis of individual market and the many factors influencing demand in each. Not surprisingly, however, when all were told, the energy GNP ratio turned out to be approximately on trend, which was rather comforting at the time. It now appears that our 1985 energy total shown here is likely to be reduced. Although efficiency trends were included for the various markets in prior projections, we had not been able to anticipate last year's military action in the Middle East, nor the staggering jump in world oil prices that flowed from it. Consumers obviously now have a much greater economic incentive to eliminate waste, and in their future purchasing habits, both business and individuals are more likely to be aware of matters related to energy efficiency for new installations and appliances. To the extent that these aims can be accomplished without also slowing the overall growth rate in the economy, this is a very favorable development. But there is a limit beyond which a reduction in energy consumption cannot be accommodated without also reducing such growth in the general economy and thus raising levels of unemployment. As a basic assumption, therefore, we start with the premise that energy demand will expand through 1985 at a rate adequate to meet the needs of the American people and their economy. Electricity will, of course, be called upon to play an important role in this process. And in view of our time limitations today, my remaining remarks will now focus on that role, to the exclusion of the other fuel markets. Projecting electricity demand has become a more frustrating task than usual this year. While we recognize that changes must be made in the prior projections to account for some price-induced elasticity, there is little useful past history that includes major electricity price changes upon which to base informed judgment. We're reduced, therefore, to evaluating an apparent impact during just the past 6 months. But these recent statistics are distorted. They're distorted by abnormal weather factors, by economic stagflation in the economy, and a residue of voluntary conservation that served to bolster our international negotiation position during a crisis period. It's unlikely that those influences will be operative throughout the remainder of the forecast years. There is a danger, therefore, of projecting future demand on the basis of recent past statistics and thus arriving at unrealistically low electricity estimates. In order to try to compensate for this, we've assumed that one, elimination of waste in electrical markets was a one-shot savings that will largely be completed in 1974. That additional conservation will indeed result from improved insulation and more efficient appliances and equipment. This, however, will be a slow and evolutionary process throughout the coming decade. That real price elasticity for electricity will vary on a regional basis and from one market to another, depending on specific end usage or the local situation in respect to availability of substitute fuels. And finally, that normal demand projections must be further adjusted to take special circumstances into account. These would include, for example, increased power needs for nuclear fuel enrichment, the growing impact of natural gas shortages, environmental problems associated with direct fuel use, and some consumer uncertainty regarding political reliability of overseas oil supplies. I have the next slide, please. Now, there are clearly many uncertainties in the present picture, not the least of which is future government policy on many energy issues. These electrical demand estimates, therefore, are very speculative and should be treated accordingly. We'll be attempting to refine them during the balance of this year as more information becomes available. In this chart, we show projections of electricity sales by market before adjustment for price elasticity and conservation. In other words, a forecast that was made prior to the Middle East War, really. You see here that total utility sales in 73, well, you can't see it actually, but the summation of those bars would show that total sales in 73 were a little over 1,700 billion kilowatt hours. And recent estimates indicated that growth might average about 7.7% a year through 1985. On this basis, sales would have totaled almost 4,150 billion kilowatt hours by that year. Rapid growth was expected for the residential market, where electric heating was making impressive inroads. But even more dramatic gains were anticipated for the commercial sector, the small light and power customers, while industrial consumption, which you can see there is the largest of the markets for electricity, largest outlet, industrial consumption was expected to retain its position, but its needs were projected to grow at a slightly lower rate than the other markets. The other category shown here includes street lighting, railroads, and miscellaneous usages. Although its volume doubles over this period, it still remains a relatively minor item. Now, if I could have the next slide. Now, in this chart, we project new estimates for each electricity market with our own preliminary downward adjustments for the impact of price-induced conservation. Based on the evidence available thus far, this leads us to believe that there will be greater reductions in the residential and commercial sales, but it will have a somewhat smaller effect in the industrial market. This assumes, of course, that regulatory bodies will not force a new move towards new pricing concepts, such as inverted rate structures, for example, that minimize the price impact on the small consumer at the expense of the large light and power customers. If that occurs, all forecasts would have to be reworked. We also saw no change in the other category here because costs are likely to have a relatively small impact on what is already a minor market. On balance, therefore, preliminary analysis of price elasticity in the electricity market indicates that demand for electricity may expand at a rate of between 6 and 6.5% per year over the longer term, rather than 7.7% as originally shown. Sales this year may in fact rise by only about 2%, but they are reflecting some rather extraordinary factors as mentioned earlier. Total consumer needs under more normal conditions and assuming satisfactory growth in the economy may be on the order of about 3,650 billion kilowatt hours by 1985, or only about 12% less than pre-energy shock forecasts. I have the next slide, please. We come finally to generation required to meet the sales forecast just discussed. Last year, utilities produced 1,850 billion kilowatt hours, as shown in the first bar over there, for all their customers and their own use and losses. And to do this, they utilized as input in electric power stations primary energy equivalent to about 9.1 million barrels per day of oil. In actual fact, however, coal provided 45% of the necessary fuel, natural gas 19%, hydro-nuclear also 19%, while oil usage, which totaled 1.5 million barrels a day, accounted for the balance. Even at the reduced demand levels, electric utility fuel supplies must more than double by 1985 if they are to generate the necessary 4,000 billion kilowatt hours that we show in the red part of the second bar over there. Now, assuming some improvement in both construction and licensing bottlenecks, we can look for approximately 275,000 megawatts of nuclear generating capacity installed by 1985. This capacity, combined with hydroelectric stations and some geothermal power, will provide about 45% of the electricity needed in that year. Fossil fuels, of course, will be called upon to furnish the balance. And in view of the natural gas supply position in this country, It appears unlikely that much more gas will be available for use under electric utility boilers by 1985. In fact, its share of this market will, in our opinion, decline steadily over the forecast period to only 6 or 7% of the total by that time. Adequate supplies of oil and coal, therefore, and particularly the latter, if we intend to at least live by the spirit of the, some spirit of the Project Independence announcement that the government has been pushing, must be available over this period if the American consumer is to receive all the electricity that he needs and wants. This will not be an easy task. There are many problems involved here. But this is an issue which each of our additional panel members will address in more detail for each of their fuels, and I leave it in their very capable hands. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Gunning. Now Mr. Brennan will address the coal problem.
Thank you, Howard. Being an economist seems to be a very hazardous occupation here. Being an economist for the coal industry is doubly hazardous. It's a very great pleasure to be here. Jerry, one comment. It's tons of coal equivalent, which is understandable to everyone, rather than barrels of oil. This year, the United States will produce about 633 million tons of bituminous coal and lignite, representing about a 7.1% increase over 1973 production. If we in fact do this, 1974 will be the best production year for coal in the history of the industry, exceeding 1947 when we produced approximately 630 million tons. Utilities will remain our largest customer in 1974, consuming approximately 403 million tons, or 63% of the total consumption. The steel industry will consume approximately 95 million tons, industrial consumption will be approximately 73 million, and exports approximately 58 million tons. To produce 633 million tons, the bituminous coal industry will deploy a capital base of approximately $4 to $5 billion and approximately 150 to 170,000 men. It will call upon the railroads to haul approximately 65 to 70% of this tonnage and provide the railroads with the largest single source of commodity revenue they have. The bulk of the production, almost 88%, will come from the traditional mining areas in the Appalachian region and the Middle West. But in 1974, for the first time, we are seeing the beginning of the impact on Western coal production. In 1974, somewhat slightly more than 50% of our coal will be mined by deep mining methods and slightly less than 50% by surface mining methods. The bulk of our coal, as I said, will move by rail, but electric high voltage transmission and barge lines will move a sizable part. In addition, there is currently operating in the United States one coal slurry pipeline. That's the industry of today. My thesis, if I have one in this discussion, is that the industry of today will, in the face of the demands as sketched by Jerry Gunning and others, gradually fade out, and the coal industry of tomorrow will be unrecognizable. Let's look then, at where the industry, the coal industry of tomorrow, will go. By 1985, we estimate that coal demand in the United States will increase by 2 to 3 times. The basic question which the United States of America must face is whether or not the demand side will meet an equilibrium on the supply side. We assume, for the sake of discussion, that supply and demand will come into balance in the period between now and 1985, and that by that year, we will be producing approximately 1.2 to 1.5 billion tons. We must also assume, and this is a somewhat shaky assumption, that the exogenous variables, the governmental and public variables, surrounding the production and sale of coal, will shift from the current rate, or from the current neutral or negative rate, to strongly expansionary, and that the coal industry